Going to call the conference committee for the Public Safety Finance Division to order. Welcome everybody, members, staff, and those in the audience. I think, why don't we just do some real quick introductions here? Most of us know each other, but just for, why don't we start with you, Senator, on that side.
Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen, District 11, representing the Alexandria area.
Neil Pauley, Senator, District 47, Coon Rapids, Champlain, Brooklyn Park.
Thank you.
Me Moore, I represent the east side of St. Paul, Senate District 67.
Alice Beichert, the Committee Administrator for the Senate Public Safety Budget Division.
Chris Turner, Fiscal Analyst.
Ken Barry, Council Research.
Linda Higgins, Senator from North Minneapolis.
I'm Michael Paymeyer. I represent part of St. Paul, the western part of St. Paul.
Melanie Lacombe, Committee Administrator, Public Safety Finance Division in the House.
Lizzie Wyoms, Committee Legislative Assistant for Representative Michael Paymeyer.
Jeff Beeble, House Research.
Kerry Carter, Fiscal Analyst, House.
Rob Eastland, State Representative from District 17A, Cambridge, Isani area, north of the Metro.
Tina Liebling, State Representative. I represent part of Rochester.
Kate Weeks, CSL Caucus Research with the House.
Kenneth Burton, Republican Research in the House.
Okay. Just in terms of process here, the conference committees were appointed. The way I understand it, Senator Foley would be a non-voting member on the Senate side and on the House side. Although they're not here, Representative Hilstrom and Bigham are non-voting members, but they would like to participate in the process. I'm not sure if and when they'll be here today. But So Senator Higgins and I talked about the agenda for today, which is basically just to have staff walk us through the side-by-sides and allow us to ask any questions. And talk through all the provisions of the bill, and then Monday we'll reconvene at the Capitol and vote on the bill. So unless there's any questions, we will be allowing public testimony, and I think as we go through the provisions, we may need to hear from people if there are some questions. Mr. Diebel, do you want to stay here? Are you okay doing it from here? Or?
Yep.
That's fine. Mr. Sackett, we'll just do it from here. I don't know how much you two have figured this out, how to walk us through it.
And Mr. Chair, are we going to ask questions as we go, or wait for the end?
I think we should, because there's a lot in here, and we'll get lost otherwise, so I think that would be good. So just feel free to ask questions as we proceed. So, Steph, are you going to ask that?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll take you through the first part of the side-by-side, beginning with the first provision, which is a Senate-only provision on the 35W bridge collapse. It's my understanding that there's a global agreement in principle on this topic and that it doesn't need to be discussed further at this point, but it is a placeholder if things fall through on that in that conference committee on House File 2553. The next provision is a House-only provision on R1. It deals with civil commitment of sexual offenders. It goes along with several other provisions in the bill that are initiatives from the county on how to mitigate the cost of housing sex offenders who are being petitioned for civil commitment. And I'll get into that in more detail when the more substantive provisions come forward. But this is just a placeholder, a cross-reference in the data practices statute to another section in the bill, Section 10. The next four provisions are Senate-only provisions. Section 2 on R2 is a part of the DOC technical bill. It retroactively removes a sunset on the law governing internet access to, that is actually not the part of the DOC. That's, excuse me on that. It is a BCA provision, and it reveals a sunset date that came and went about a year ago, and it would be retroactive to that date. The next provision is from Section 3 on R2, is a part of their reentry initiative, and that directs the Commissioner of Corrections to develop and maintain a formal marketing plan to attract private businesses and industries to employ inmates through MinCorp. Section 4, again, is a Senate-only provision, but it does have a corollary in a bill that's on the House floor and awaiting action, and this is part of the DOC technical bill. The language updates a statutory cross-reference regarding the Interstate Adult Offender Supervision Compact. Section 5 is a part of the same DOC technical bill, and that's on R3, and it simply changes the due date for the Advisory Council on Interstate Adult Offender Supervision's annual report from January 15th to March 1st. On R3 and 4, there's a House-only provision that defines the term social networking website in the Predatory Offender Registration Statute, and that ties together with a substantive provision further in the bill, and I'll discuss that in more detail in a minute. Section 3 in the, is on the House side, on R4 of the side-by-side, is a House-only provision, and it requires predatory offenders who is incarcerated but who lack the primary address upon release to register with the law enforcement agency in the jurisdiction over the offender, over the area where the offender plans to stay upon release, and he must do this within 5 days prior to his release from prison. Turning to R6 of the side-by-side, Section 4 is a House-only provision, and actually contains two separate initiatives. The first is it permits the BCA to mail a predatory offender verification form to the local law enforcement authority where a homeless predatory offender most recently reported. And that is an agency initiative. The second provision in that section, Section 4, is to allow, is to require registered predatory offenders to is to prohibit registered predatory offenders from accessing social networking websites, which, as I mentioned earlier, is defined previously in the bill. And that would be effective August 1st, 2009, to avoid a fiscal impact in this biennium. And there is no comparable provision on the Senate side.
Did the House talk about how in the world you're going to enforce this?
Senator Higgins, we had a hearing on this, and Representative Bigham is not here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought maybe I could help a little bit, because I do recall the hearing on this, and I recall that the department felt that this is not really very far from what they do already, that the agents that supervise the folks are already looking at their computers, and I don't remember all the specifics, but I do recall that that question was asked and that they felt that it was very easily within what they're able to do.
If you look on R9, in Section 6, I think this may answer the question, I'm not sure, but it says, talk about on lines 814 through 820 the conditions that the commissioner may impose. So this is really adding the computer or like, so I suspect that a probation officer could probably do a random search of the computer. This is your bill too, isn't it?
Sure is, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, you notice that there's no comparable language from the Senate. And the reason for that is because we were concerned. We brought up, it was our intention to bring a number of these department bills for hearing, and when we did put on the agenda and started from the hearing, a number of the, and this was, you may know, right when we were all hitting deadlines, we were double shifting in the Senate, meeting almost, the Judiciary Committee, House Committee is meeting almost twice a day. And we really wanted to get these bills through, but when I presented the bills to committee members raised a lot of questions, and we just felt like there was just not enough time to give it the proper airing that we needed to give it, as well as to work with the department to make sure that members of the committee were satisfied. So I tell these are my bills, and my committee, my committee have problems with my bills. And so as the chair, I laid them over, and we just ran out of time. So that's why we raised some concerns.
I think what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, in deference to Representative Bigham, who you know spoke very passionately about her two provisions that are in the bill, if we could maybe hold off and like give her an opportunity, and maybe have DOC also talk about whether if there's any problems with it. But if we could just hold off until when is she coming back? She'll be back here within the hour, so. Okay, thank you. Whitney Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's fine. Mr. Carter just handed me the fiscal note, and I just, before we went on, wanted to point out that it does say in the fiscal note that it's anticipated the provisions, this is under the assumption section, it's anticipated the provisions of the bill regarding sex offenders' access to the social networking website will have a minimal impact on the workload for supervising agents statewide and a minimal prison bed impact. Intensive supervision agents currently check offenders' computers for inappropriate use, which may be grounds for violation.
Mr. Chair, members, first thing is I wasn't sure if that fiscal note is the most recent one. We had requested a brand new fiscal note because it wasn't entirely clear. I don't think there was a bed impact statement in there, so I don't know if the new fiscal note is prepared. I haven't seen it. If it is.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Backus, yes, we do have the current fiscal note. We just received it today, and I think, I don't know if copies are being made, or we can have copies made on that fiscal note.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think when Representative Bingham comes, I think we do need a little more conversation about this, because I think we've got Section 6 talks about those people under intensive supervised release from corrections, but the page before it, the actual social profile, social networking website, is everybody who has to register. So that's a whole different universe of people. So, or not different, but they are different universes of people.
I'm not sure that that's correct. As I understand it, it's level 3 predatory offenders for, but why don't we wait and have someone from DOC as well as they're going to discuss that section in more detail. Let's wait for Representative Bigham. I just feel like she really wanted to be here during this discussion, and we got a lot to go through. So.
Mr. Chair, and to be fair to my co-author, I mean, she does feel very passionately about this, and I did make a commitment to the department that I would bring it to the Judiciary Committee. And honest to goodness, we tried. And, to the extent that if we can take some testimony and we can help to the extent that we can, I'm not hostile to the idea. These are my bills. But I just also know that Judiciary Committee members have problems with it. So,
Okay, so we'll pick it up when she gets here, and then we can air all of that out. So, where were we?
Mr. Chair and members, continuing on with language on R9 of the side-by-side, Section 5, it's a house-only provision, and it clarifies that a person can be required to register as a predatory offender based on a conviction for a crime against the person after a conviction for a previous predatory offense when the previous predatory offense occurred in another state. And I believe it's intended to fill a loophole in the statute for those coming from other states with other convictions. Also on R9 is the language we've already discussed, which is allowing for the Commissioner of Corrections to conduct unannounced searches of computers used by offenders placed on intensive supervised release, and that would be both predatory offenders and really anyone that's under intensive supervised release by the department. Again, there's no comparable Senate provision on that. The next section is also R10, is Section 7, and this is a cross-reference to the Section 8. These are the provisions related to civil commitment and reducing the cost on counties. Section 8 is the substantive part of this. It permits sex offenders who are being held pending resolution of a civil commitment petition to elect to stay in a DOC facility or a county correctional facility instead of in a Minnesota sex offender program facility. The statute goes on to discuss the grounds for granting such an order and for revoking an order, and the limits the amount of time a person may stay in a DOC facility to under this statute to 210 days. This language has been worked out between the counties, the county attorneys, Department of Corrections, and the Department of Human Services, and as I understand it, has passed the Senate in a substantively identical way through Senate File 3168, Article 2, and is pending conference in the Department of Human Services policy bill.
Mr. Chair, just information for the members that Senator Berglund's bill did come through the Judiciary Committee, and we did give it a full airing and hearing and sent it on. That's why Senator Higgins is the companion. That bill didn't get the hearing because we felt like we had given a hearing to the other bill that was going through that may not be the companion, but we did give it a full airing. So.
I was the author of the Senator Berglund bill.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, continuing R12, it's Section 9 of the House language, and this is also part of the civil commitments reform in 7 and 8, Section 7 and 8, and this authorizes the Commissioner of Corrections to charge counties for housing the offenders that are staying there pending civil commitment, and it obligates the DHS, or Department of Human Services, to fund all non-commitment, non-confinement costs of the Department of Correction incurs in housing these offenders pending resolution of their civil commitment petition.
Can I just ask, Mr. Carter, do we know how much money this would save the counties, or was that not calculated?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe that was calculated.
Okay.
We could, if you would like to come up with maybe a possible savings.
The next provision on R12 is a Senate-only provision, and this deals again with civil commitment. It's not related to the other provisions, but the intent of the law is to authorize persons being held for potential civil commitment and treatment facility heads to demand an immediate hearing, which must be provided within 5 days of the date of demand. And if this occurs, if this does not occur, the 5-day deadline is not met, the patient must be discharged. This section exempts persons being petitioned as mentally ill and dangerous, sexually dangerous, or as having a sexual psychopathic personality from this 5-day demand requirement of a hearing. And this was actually sent to the governor in a different form via Senate File 2919, but it was vetoed yesterday. And my understanding is that the language that the Senate has in a side-by-side is a better way to approach the problem, and the governor would accept the language as is on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, this was a Senator Betzel's bill on the Senate side, and he was in the awkward position of asking the governor to veto his bill because they had gotten it wrong. And so he's included in this, and this is the point that they wanted to make, was that the 5-day window doesn't apply to the commitment petition as it says in the paragraph B. But originally, in the original Senator Betzel's bill, that affected both paragraphs A and B, which was not what anybody wanted. So we hope that you will look kindly on this provision.
Continuing, Mr. Chair, Section 10 on R13 is a health-only provision, and it is part of the bill on civil commitment brought forward by the counties. And this provision authorizes county attorneys, without a court order, to acquire data held by the Department of Corrections or parole or probation authority for the purpose of determining whether good cause exists to petition for the civil commitment of a sex offender. The county attorney must provide prior notice of the request to the subject at the time that request is made. And this, again, doesn't have a comparable provision in the side-by-side, but is moving forward in Senate File 3168. Section 11 on R14 is related to the series of sections on civil commitment, and this simply states that it allows for state reimbursement of the cost of holding persons in a DOC facility pending resolution of a civil commitment petition. This is the statute that is only effective if the governor, if the legislature appropriates money for the purpose, but if that occurs, then the counties could request that the state pay for 50% of housing the cost, 50% of the cost of housing these offenders that are held pending civil commitment. The next section is a house-only provision, and it's on R14 and R15, and has to do with a change to the recently enacted e-charging statute. And e-charging, if you recall, is a BCA initiative service to provide communication and workflow tools for law enforcement, prosecutors, and the courts to use during the process of charging a person with a crime. And this was enacted, but there were some concerns about the data classification and the burden placed on those that were the subject of the data classification. And so the House has proposed amending the statute by amending Subdivision 2, which treats the data as changes the classification of the data for purposes of access by the individual. And so you'll see in Subdivision 2, the new language will remove the classification of confidential data on individuals or protected non-public data after the investigation becomes inactive, at which point the BCA may disclose the data to the subject of the investigation, and the data is reclassified as private data on individuals or non-public data. And this change in Subdivision 2 eliminates the need for the language in Subdivision 4, and that would be deleted, which had set out the protocol for subjects of the data to obtain information in the e-charging chain. And at this point, Mr. Backus will take over.
Mr. Chair and members, and I'm not sure if Mr. Diebel or anyone else mentioned it, but there is a side-by-side summary that Mr. Diebel and I prepared, which also walks you through it, but in a summarized form, and that should be in your packet. I'll be working off the side-by-side, though. Page R17, and then going on to R18 are two Senate-only provisions which relate to this new concept called the Certificate of Good Conduct, which I'll go into more detail in a minute. These are basically conforming law changes. Continuing on then to R19, Section 9, Senate position, is the Certificate of Good Conduct. And basically what it is it allows a person who's been convicted or adjudicated a delinquent for a crime to petition a court for this certificate. The person would have to pay a filing fee, the standard civil filing fee. And there's a provision that provides that the person is not eligible to apply if he or she has applied for a certificate within the past 2 years or for an expungement within the past 2 years. Subdivision 2 gives some detailed information about what has to be in the petition. Most of that came from the expungement law, which this remedy is somewhat similar to. Subdivision 3 on page R20 talks about who has to be served with notice of the petition, etc. Subdivision 4 provides that, if possible, the sentencing judge should preside over the hearing, and that the victim has a right to submit a statement, and that the judge has to consider the statement when making the decision. Subdivision 5 provides eligibility for the certificate, and to be eligible, a person must have been successfully discharged from his or her sentence, cannot be currently required to be registering as a predatory offender, and has to have been law-abiding for at least the preceding 3 years for most people, and if you had to register as a predatory offender, then for the preceding 5 years. You'd have to demonstrate rehabilitation, and there's some examples on how you can do that. You have to either paid or making good faith efforts to pay court-imposed fees, restitution, etc. And then if the underlying crime involved an alcohol or controlled substance as an element, then you have to be not abusing alcohol or controlled substances. Finally, you have to show that the certificate is consistent with the public interest, and the judge can impose other factors if the judge chooses to. Subdivision 6 provides that it's a preponderance of the evidence standard in order to receive a certificate, which is the lowest.
Mr. Chairman?
Attorney Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that, what is the crime for the definition? Does that include some traffic violation? What have we got included in that?
On what subdivision are you talking about?
Well, we just got through dealing with the thing in R20.
Mr. Chern, I don't believe crime is defined, although petty misdemeanors are not considered crime, so I don't think it would occur to them. Either way, the certificate only affects housing, employment, and licensing provisions, and there is a provision later that clarifies that it doesn't apply to things like, say, DWI licensing actions and things like that. So my reading is it only applies to misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and felonies. And most traffic offenses aren't those.
Mr. Chairman, it would seem to me that that should be placed on for reconsideration or considering cover the offenses that might be covered. An alcohol violation, for instance. That absent testing and so forth, why we don't know what kind of results we're going to get on that. So I'm not trying to make this any more difficult, but it seems to me that we need some clarity on that area.
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, do you mean in the part on the eligibility paragraph where we say that if their offense related to alcohol or drugs, they have to prove that they are not now abusing alcohol or drugs?
That would be one, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're going to have some discussion on this, but why don't you finish up on the certificate. And
Mr. Chair, members, and continuing, Subdivision 7 requires the court to notify the BCA of the court's ruling and then the BCA to record it on the petitioner's criminal record. Subdivision 8 is an important one. It tells you about the effect of the certificate. Basically, it creates a presumption of rehabilitation in favor of the person to whom it was issued, and it relieves that person of any state-imposed collateral sanction related to employment, housing, or professional or occupational licensing. There's some specific language that was added in the Senate to clarify the application of the certificate to DHS background checks, so that the Commissioner of Human Services can't disqualify an individual solely for a crime for which the individual has received the certificate, and that if the Commissioner has previously disqualified a person, that then the Commissioner shall rescind the disqualification. Paragraph C provides that the housing or licensing authority or employer may consider a conviction even if it's the subject of a certificate but doesn't have to. Paragraph D provides civil and criminal immunity for a authority who relies on a certificate. Paragraph E then provides that it's evidence relating to a conviction for which a certificate has been issued is inadmissible in a civil action based on negligence in either renting, hiring, or licensing. So it's kind of the flip side of the preceding paragraph. And then paragraph F provides that the existence of the certificate is admissible as evidence of reasonable care by a person who relied on it when making one of those decisions. Subdivision 9 provides that the certificate is revoked by operation of law if the person is subsequently convicted or adjudicated of a new crime. Subdivision 10 reiterates the limited effect of the certificate, that it only applies to those things you talk about, licensing and employment and housing. And then Subdivision 11 provides a misdemeanor penalty for misuse of the certificate.
Perhaps we could have some discussion about this. And I don't know if there's anyone here from the administration who... Is anyone here? I understand there is some concern about about this provision. We and this bill was not heard in the House, although Representative Eastland and myself and Senator Higgins during the interim had lengthy discussions with our reentry working group about this. So we've had a lot of discussion about it, but it did not have a hearing in the House. And I understand that the governor's office has some concerns about it, and it would be nice if it's fixable, but let's hear from, you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the Licensing Division of the Department of Human Services. And I've been asked to come and just inform the committee that the governor's office has now reviewed this provision of the bill, the Certificate of Good Conduct, and wants me to relay that the governor's office is very opposed to this thing, especially, as I understand it, as it relates to the background studies completed by the Department of Human Services that are referenced very clearly under 245C.
Can you, is Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Kerber, yes.
Yeah. Could you elaborate a little bit more what you're saying?
The Department of Human Services has been doing background studies on people who provide direct contact services in a variety of licensed programs since 1991. In 1995, we started doing them for the health department as well. So we do somewhere between 225 to 250,000 background studies every year. And those are background studies that we do on people who work in a variety of settings, from child care centers to assisted living programs to nursing homes, chemical dependency treatment programs, mental health programs. We do them on people who provide services for otherwise unlicensed PCA agencies. There's quite a variety of human services and health services that are covered under this background study law. The law is quite prescriptive, as many of the members are aware, and it delineates which types of crimes we look for with specific look-back periods for the different levels of crime. And then we disqualify people. Those people have an opportunity to request a reconsideration of those decisions. And in most cases, they can argue either that the disqualification was incorrect, that we had wrong information, or that, notwithstanding the fact that they have that history, today they don't pose a risk of harm. And there are a number of variables that we need to consider that are specified in law in making a decision about whether that person should have a set aside for that particular type of service. The law is very clear that when we grant a set-aside, it is specific to one license setting at a time. And the law is also clear that when we make that decision, the preeminent weight must be placed on the health and safety of the people receiving services over the interests of the individual or even the employer. And so the concern is that this kind of shifts that decision-making process away from the administrative agency that may be closest to the situation and already in a position of having some responsibility for the health and safety of children and vulnerable adults, and moves it back to the court system where there might be a different balancing of issues.
Mr. Kerber,
Mr. Kerber, out of those 250 or 300,000 licensing actions that the department does, how many of those folks actually get a set aside?
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, of those studies that we do, there are about 10,000 people a year who get a disqualification notice from us. A little less than half of those people request a reconsideration of that decision. And about a third of them, let me just check, anticipating this question, about two-thirds of the people who request a set-aside and go through the process of demonstrating how today they don't pose a risk of harm, two-thirds of them are given that set-aside of that disqualification and allowed to work in that specific setting that they're interested in. So it's about two-thirds of a little less than half of 10,000.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber, do you not see in our provision here the parallel action that DHS does where the folks
in our bill, put together their whole background of all of their actions and how they have been rehabilitating themselves since they have been incarcerated, and go to a court and say, you know, that they are now asking for this small certificate that says that they are rehabilitated to such a level that they can go forward.
Mr. Fairbanks.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, in looking at the bill, I think it's clear to see that there are some parallels, as you suggest. When we look at the variables that we must consider, some are overlapping here. We're generally interested in things like, is there any evidence of rehabilitation? How long has it been since the offense? But at the same time, what we have to go a little bit deeper in our review to determine who was the victim of the crime, what's the similarity between that victim and the type of people receiving services, and really make an analysis that's specific to that employment arrangement. Whereas the Certificate of Good Conduct, as I read it here, is a kind of a blanket approval that it would apply to housing, it would apply to our employment arrangements, it would apply kind of across the board, without there being a specific review of those services where the person wants to work. In our review, we sometimes make a very different decision if somebody wants to provide home care services that are essentially very unsupervised. When a person goes into a vulnerable person's home, a history of theft may have much more significance than it might have in a nursing home arrangement where they're going to be in housekeeping. It may not, but it may. There's a lot more supervision in that nursing home arrangement. And so, same with a child care center. There's not necessarily access to personal property of children that's an issue like there might be in a nursing home. And so the decision has to get very specific.
Did you want to testify on this also? Nelson?
Representing again administration. Could
you just introduce yourself for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Kelly Nelson, Deputy Commissioner of the Community Services for the Department of Corrections. And first, I guess I'd like to preface that the concept is good. I think everybody believes that this is a good concept. I think that as far as reentry and Second Chance Act and all of those things, that something along this line needs to be done. But here are some of the concerns. The scope, it's not limited to Minnesota convictions. It could utilized in convictions in other states. There's some complexities with that. I'm not saying that it couldn't be worked out, but I don't know that that's been thought through. The hearing process, there's no adversarial type of process to create a meaningful record, and the entirety of the record is actually what is pulled together by the ex-offender for the court. The question then is there going to be verification and validation of that? And if there is verification and validation of what the ex-offender presents to the court, who's going to do that? And that, at the time of the first was introduced, I guess that was an issue that nobody was sure of. I don't think the judiciary would probably need some assistance. I don't know where they would go. If they did go to corrections and probation officers, that would be in addition to their workload. But I'm not sure that the judge is even required to do that, but that's an issue. The eligibility, if it's overly broad, does not contain any minimum waiting period and so forth. From discharge of sentence compared to the Board of Pardons. 3 years and 5 years, law-abiding, there's a question of what is the definition of law-abiding, and I know that there's some other things that you check out. The effect that undermines the legislative mandates of 245C, which has already been discussed, and I won't go into that. So I think that's a good concept. I think it needs more work, and I think what happened kind of with it being introduced and then pulled and coming in at the last, I don't think it got the scrutiny and the vetting that it should have had. But the governor's office administration is not necessarily opposed to the concept. They're just opposed to the way that it's currently written.
Mr. Nelson, you know that former Deputy Commissioner Benson was on the working group and that studied this whole Certificate of Good Conduct over the summer.
I'm aware of that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Can I ask either one of you, do you have any recommendations on how we could tighten up the language, or is there a way still to make this workable? Mr. Kerber, do you have a...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the governor's office is willing to try to work on it. I don't know if there's enough time to get it done, but they're not ruling out the seeing if this didn't get an order. I know that the time is short, but and that may be difficult to do at this late stage. But again, they are not against the concept, just against the way it's written now with those concerns to those problems.
Mr. Chairman, we had, what, two committee hearings on this. The last hearing where we put it back in was because we had to work out issues on the fiscal note. And we told the committee members when we pulled it out of the bill originally that if we could figure out the fiscal note and some of the other underlying issues, we would put it back in again. I think there were, folks from lots of departments who were sitting there as we were going through that. I'm willing to work out details if there are details. I think some of the issues of concern that you have are, I frankly don't see. But I'm happy to keep working on this. I think, too, it's an important thing to do. When you have 7,000 people coming out of incarceration every year in this state, and they face significant barriers to getting jobs and a decent place to live, and we know that getting them on the path to a good job and to a decent place to live makes it more likely they will be law abiding, and so I think that we should put our heads together. I guess I get a little disturbed when the first you hear about issues is here and coming in and saying you oppose it. When people from GOC have been, working through these issues with us. And, Mr. Chair, I do know that we have other people from our working group who are here, and maybe we can have some on-the-street testimony from some of the folks as well.
And just to respond, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, and this got off our radio screen, and if there's negligence on our part and not following through, I will carry that on my shoulders, because this is my area, and I should have been more on top of it.
Mr. Chair.
Very
much. Mr. Chair, it wasn't just your working group over the summer that looked at this issue. You may recall that in the budget last year, you and Senator Higgins both gave $100,000 for a collateral sanctions working group to work over the summer and to come back with recommendations. Senator Higgins appointed me to sit on that working group, and we did have a subcommittee that worked on some recommendations, including expungements, certificate of good conduct, just a number of different remedies to address the collateral sanctions that I think Mr. Gerber very well articulated. That we do have a number of collateral sanctions out there that are prohibiting and, in fact, has become a real barrier for people from getting jobs. And to the extent that we can try to address that with different tools, we wanted to do that. It was the intention of all of us to do that, and we funded that working group. So while the two of you were engaging in your working group coming back to the same conclusion, the collateral sanctions working group also came up with the certificate of good conduct as a recommendation. And let me also add that I believe that Mr. Harry Kennedy from the governor's office participated in that working group all throughout the summer. And when the working group put the recommendations together, I think that the governor's office was aware that this is one of the remedies or one of the tools that we intended to bring back to the legislature. Senator Higgins just beat me to the punch. I mean, I would have done it too as part of, the portfolio of products that we have thought about. The other piece that I have to put on the table is that, in the Senate, we gave this bill two full hearings and ample time and opportunity for individuals to step forward. And, I think that our Judiciary Committee has a reputation that we work bills in the committee. When we spend time and we make the time to really make sure that the bills are in good shape to go forward, and we incorporate and we take comments, and we work with different stakeholders to make sure that the bills we move forward are bills we can stand by. That's why some bills don't move forward, because we want to move out a good product. So I feel like at the ninth hour, after we've given the amount of work that we have to this, to say that it's too late to participate, I think that we need to make small steps, and to the extent that we need to move forward, we need to move forward. We expended two legislative sessions on this issue.
Well, and yeah, I would like to hear from some of the working group members, and you know, we don't have a lot of time, but if anyone wants to testify, I would like to give a charge to Mr. Kerbert and Mr. Nelson to come up with some language that you think would satisfy the governor's office, Department of Corrections, and we have time over the weekend, and we're not going to vote on this until Monday, and if, you know, I Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Cain, C-A-I-N. I'm the president of an organization called RS Eden, and I had the privilege of serving on the working group. A couple things that I would point out that, having listened to the comments, first off, the Collateral Sanctions Committee that made recommendations that included this certificate of good conduct also made recommendations specific to Minnesota Chapter 245C, the licensing rule that Mr. Kerber was talking about here. And one thing I would point out that I think was inadvertently left out of the discussion earlier is that 245C also has, I believe, 27 crimes that permanently prohibit someone from working in any Department of Human Services or Department of Health license program. And there is no set aside. So the fact that there were 10,000 applications that were turned down and only half requested a set aside may be a little bit misleading, in that there were obviously a number of those that didn't request a set aside who, after I think it was last year's action or the year before, are no longer eligible for that. That is a recommendation that's come out of the Collateral Sanctions Committee. I think their recommendation is a good one. As it relates to the Certificate of Good Conduct, one thing that is heartening to me is the fact that there seems to be universal recognition of the need here. There are a number of areas where we've tried to address the issues of discrimination against people with criminal records that really works against the concept of public safety and sets it up so that they have very few options for housing and employment. I guess from a personal level, if there were a willingness to work on this certificate with enough time to get it done this session, I would commit all of the time that I have to get that done. I think that we all kind of knew that there were some things and some areas in the certificate that probably could be tweaked and modified as we move forward. I think the fiscal note is probably based upon some assumptions that I'm not too sure are true, but the fact that there's universal recognition that we need to do something is something that warms my heart, because I think it's way long overdue. But you know, I would ask that, you know, this not get lost in politics. It's something that needs to be done in order to create a level playing field. You know, I believe that philosophically our state and our United States government, in fact, is founded on a concept of, you know, you pay your debt and you can move on, redemption, so to speak. And I believe that it is incumbent upon us to do everything that we can to create a path to a level playing field. You know, we don't have to put people on a level playing field, and we certainly can't make decisions for them to get on there, but there has to be a path to one. And this is a potential path. It's one that has been adopted in several other states in different forms. And I would just say that if it was the committee's wish to try and get something done with enough time for this session, I'll commit whatever time I can to do that between now and when the deadlines are.
Thank you, Mr. Cain. Any questions? sending it to Klingelbeck.
Chair, I guess the obvious question here is, and I know we did do a lot of talk about it on the Senate side. This might be a rookie question. Why nothing on the House side? Why was there no discussion, or was there a lot of discussion on the House?
Well, what happened on the House side was when we got the fiscal note, there was $1.2 million. Well, there was $1 million fiscal note, and we were given instructions by our leadership to not include any new policies that had a fiscal impact. On the Senate side, you were able to figure out a way to fund the certificate of good conduct, and we'd never thought of that. So that's why we stripped the language out when it came before the Finance Committee, and all we ended up with was the Working Group on Substance Abuse.
Thank you.
Can someone from the County Attorney's Office, if you want
to... Right here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I am speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I do have a handout. It's a letter from the executive director that I'll have distributed as Chairman Tamar and Senator Higgins and Senator Moi are certainly aware. We testified, I believe, at both of the hearings in the House and the Senate on this. The County Attorneys Association was part of the working group and has supported public policy on prisoner reentry as a crucial criminal justice issue. And certainly in today's digital age, when we're talking about the certificates of good conduct, in this digital age, sealing a conviction or expunging one is really problematic because, as the courts know, they have data miners sitting in their offices every day getting this information, and it's already out there in the public. And that this is a much more pragmatic way of dealing with that issue. At their February 15th, 2008 meeting, the MCAA Board of Directors voted to make the reentry issue a legislative priority, and that included the certificates of good conduct. Now, certainly, as to the testimony that was presented here earlier by the governor's office, we're willing to work with whoever in ironing out problems that they have, and we will be willing to work with the committee, with anyone else who raises those kinds of concerns, happy to participate in that discussion as we have been from the beginning. So we are willing to work with you on that.
Mr. Chair?
I think we're going to leave on the first one.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony and for being here today. I wanted to turn to one of the specific concerns that was raised before by the administration about the lack of an adversarial process and in expungement proceedings. I know that in fact there is an adversarial process, and I don't recall what the language of the expungement statute is, but as I'm looking at the language here in this bill, the county attorney is present in this, certainly, in that it's supposed to be served on the county attorney, and the county attorney has some specific duties. I'm looking here for where I saw that. Okay. 7.27, service of the petition and proposed order. So the petitioner has to serve all of this on the prosecutorial office that had jurisdiction over the offense for which the certificate sought, and then in fact the prosecutor has some duties here to serve that, to notify the victim and so on, and then we go down in subdivision 4 and we're talking about a hearing. So my question to you is, even though it doesn't specifically say so, wouldn't you sort of read here that the prosecutor is in fact present at the hearing and that there is in fact an adversarial process that's supposed to take place here?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I can defer to Senate or House counsel. I believe that much of this language was taken directly from the expungement statute, and as I said before, if there's something from the agencies or the departments where they want to make that even more explicit, we're certainly willing to work with them. My understanding in talking with the County Attorneys Association people was that it would in fact be an adversarial hearing if the victim or the prosecutor wanted it to be. There are certainly a number of expungement type hearings that happen now where we don't oppose them or choose to participate. We notify the victims, but we don't choose to participate in there. But that would be available. But there again, if there's some language that people want to come up with that makes that explicit, we're certainly willing to work with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And then following up on that a little bit, where they're saying here, the administration is saying that because they think there was no adversarial process going on here, the preponderance of evidence standard is problematic. I take it then that you would say that given the role of the county attorney would obviously want to vet some of this, what was submitted. And I take it then that you would say that you would be okay with the preponderance of evidence standard?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, there are actually two questions in there, and I'll do my best to answer both. First is the vetting of the information, and that I have to say I haven't thought about as much in the minutes since I heard that testimony, and I'm certainly willing to work with them. I certainly understood the concerns, particularly from Mr. Nelson, about the quality of information that's getting to the court or getting to whoever's making that decision. And again, if they have some language that they want that would help us make sure that the court has the very best information, we're willing to work with them. The second issue has to do with the standards, the preponderance of the evidence, and the county attorney's willingness to sign on to this and to actually support the preponderance. It's no accident that that's a lower standard of proof, and I think that comes out of a policy decision that we would rather limit how these records are used than hide the ball with expungement. Because frankly, from our standpoint, expungements are horrifically expensive to the courts, to us, to the police department, law enforcement. It's hiding records that in reality are already out there for the employers who want to use them. And that this is a better mechanism of doing that. And we would rather people use this than an expungement, and therefore we made it easier for them to get. On the other hand, I understand the concern from the administration that when you do that, it's actually going to make it easier for people to get these. And one of the issues that, frankly, I had not had an opportunity to consider before this was the notion that the reviews they are doing are, in fact, offense-specific. And obviously, if they have information that they want or language, we're willing to work with them on that. I can't emphasize that enough. But the standard of proof wasn't an accident. We want to encourage people to use these and not the more expensive and less effective expense.
That leaves us.
Mr. Bassett, do you have anything else?
Mr. Chair and members, no, I, if you'd like, I could confirm what Mr. Brown said, that the procedural provisions in terms of service of the prosecutors and victim participation is basically identical with the expungement law. So any kind of adversarial process that the expungement law provides, this would provide. There was initially some language in the Senate bill that went a step beyond the expungement law and allowed people call witnesses and things like that. That was taken out because of concerns about the fiscal cost that the courts raised. And then another thing is that if you look at the Subdivision 5 eligibility provision, there's some restrictions that apply to the typically good conduct that wouldn't apply necessarily to the expungement law, at least inherent authority expungements, which is something that the legislature has really no control over. So in some ways, you could even argue that it's somewhat more limited than eligibility.
Unless there are further questions, but thank the committee for its consideration.
Thank you, and thank you for your willingness to try to work this out. I'm still hopeful that we can do that. Mr. Kerbert and Mr. Nelson, will you just come back up? I just want to make sure that we have... Mm-hmm. you've heard the testimony from the County Attorneys Association as well as this committee. I'm just wondering if it would be feasible to work something out and come up with some language by tomorrow, since Mr. Brown and Mr. Kane have offered their services, and there might be members of the committee that would be willing. Is this doable? Is it based on what you've heard?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I can guarantee that it's doable. I can guarantee that I'm willing to try, and I'll avail my time and whoever else we need to be part of it as far as from Corrections Department, we will try our darndest. Just one concern or one question, though. When you're talking about the quality of the information and so forth, and I guess what usually happens in a court process many times, the judge will go to the probation officer and ask for a pre-sentence investigation or ask for post-sentence investigation sometimes is requested or a time that there is a possibility of releasing the offender on his own recognizance, they go to the probation officer. If the judges were to say, I want this information verified and validated, that is probably the direction that they would go, and that's probably the direction I would suggest they go. If we were to do that, however, you're going to put some more strain on the probation officers, which are already quite heavily working. And so there's a question there. If that happens and if the numbers get to be great, there's a question of fiscal note again, needing more probation officers in the court.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that was made a few minutes ago in the process, the adversarial process. There was part of the process originally was involved witnesses and involved that sort of thing. How did taking that language out affect the cost of this proposal?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, what happened is, again, this provision was part of the original bill, went through all the policy committees, and then the bill came to Senator Higgins' budget division. There, by that point, we had gotten the fiscal note. She deleted the provision temporarily, so the fiscal note should be worked on. We had a series of meetings with the courts and some other people to discuss the problems from their point of view, what the costs were. And one of the costs was the length of the hearing. They were initially predicting that it was going to be between 15 and 45 minutes per hearing with an average of 30 minutes. So we discussed ways possibly of, in some cases, we felt that was a little high anyway because a good number of these are not going to be contested, and a 30-minute hearing average would be a contested hearing, we assumed. But we also wanted to figure out ways that maybe we can tweak that a little bit lower and lower. And one way that the courts identified was that there was a sentence saying that you could call witnesses to refute or establish eligibility for the certificate. Now, that's not part of the expungement law. That was something that was added last summer when I initially worked on this with Senator Neville when he was a senator, and that stayed in the bill the whole time until that was pulled going back to finance. Now, the courts never identified, like, each little change we made, how much money that may or may not save. So maybe you could ask the courts how big an issue that is for them financially. But it was something we thought would save some money, but we don't know how much.
Mr. Chair, I guess just in looking at it, I mean, there is some validity, and maybe this is the same language that's in the expungement law, I'm not sure, but really the only two things that are at play here in the process are the victim's testimony, and the testimony of the person seeking the... But in chapter or line 8, verse 10, it says, the judge shall consider the victim's statement when making a decision. And that's really the only directive to the judge. Even though we've got all this other stuff in place above it, on line 10 there, it talks about the victim stuff and all they can do, and they can bring all their victim, we can bring concerns. But I guess theoretically, there could be concerns that might come from someplace other than a victim. And the witness component of that would have addressed that issue. So I guess there's a sense where you could look at this and say that it is an attempt to really skinny down the process to the point where maybe it would open up some opportunity for a little less scrutiny. And I say this as somebody who supports. I served on the working committee. I've been a supporter of of these kind of programs for years, and I think this is the direction we need to go in. But I guess I'm also concerned that we move ahead in a way that we can do it, you know, across the administrative gamut, and so that we can all move ahead feeling good about what we've done. So my hope would be that if we can find commonality and some agreement with the governor's office, that would be a great accomplishment. But it's a concern that we're at this point in the process, and we're trying to cobble something together on something that's this important. So I guess that's kind of my point of view right here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think as Mr. Brown said, the county attorneys are a part of this, and of course they would oppose it if they thought that that was the prudent thing to do. We also say on 8.32 and 3.3 that the other factors that are deemed relevant by the court can be brought in. And I think that goes to the issue that you said, where there might be somebody other than the victim who had relevant information as well.
In response to that, and I think that's it's clear, and I think for those that have been working on the issue, I think we can read this and we can see that in here. But for somebody who just all of a sudden sees this and looks at it, they begin to ask questions of what about this case, what about that case, and is there a way somebody could slip through the cracks here? How would somebody that has a concern be notified and even know if all we're doing is contacting the prosecutor? You know, so there's just I can see why somebody would look at this and have concerns. I just think that's an issue that it's unfortunate that we have to be at this point in the process and be trying to tackle these issues, because I think it's going to be difficult to come to a satisfactory solution, because part of being comfortable with this is looking at it over time and beginning to really think through how it's going to work and how it's going to benefit us in a larger sense.
Thank you both. Senator Flores and Englewood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After listening to Representative Eastland, I think we've got something here to look at, and there's been a lot of work on it, and I think there's fairly good agreement that this is the way to go. But on the other hand, can we wrap this up this afternoon by doing something that has already gone before committees, and a lot of people have heard this, so the study group goes for 2 months, and at least in the Senate, there were hearings on there, extensive hearings, in fact, and we've spent a considerable amount of time here. So the question is, can we wrap this up in the next half hour or hour or something like that? And if not, maybe we should consider some alternatives.
Well, I think we're almost ready to wrap it up now. I think the charge is now is whether we can expect some language from the administration that would satisfy the governor's office and it's workable. And if you can give us that assurance that you can do that, then we'll just keep working on it. I mean, it is a little disconcerting, Mr. Nelson, that there was representation on the Collateral Sanctions Committee from the Department of Corrections, and that Mr. Benson was at almost every one of those meetings over the summer, and now you're coming to the Conference Committee saying you're uncomfortable with it. I have to say, it's disconcerting after putting all that work into it. And then not to come here with any suggestions, just to come and say, these are our concerns, when we have some deadlines to deal with. So again, I guess I would. Oh, Representative Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, thank you. That would be one of my concerns too. Is that was one of the testifiers Mr. Nelson talked about was the possibility of the probation officers getting involved here, not knowing that probably up front. So I guess if we're going to move forward with this and try and do this over the weekend and work together, I would really like to have that narrowed down when you start talking about the cost and you start charging the fee and make sure that's all rolled in here. And then, of course, I'm a little bit concerned about the 15 to 45 minute hearing process, too, whether that's quite long enough. So just some questions, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, if we are going to say that there should be a validation and verification of the information that's provided by the ex-offender, and whoever does that, is there's going to be an increase in the fiscal vote, and I don't know if that's something that you want to deal with.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingram.
Yeah, just in response to that, that was exactly my concern was, is to make sure that the fiscal note is more accurate when we move forward here.
Mr. Kerbert, what are you saying? Is there a way to work through this by noon tomorrow?
excuse me, Mr. Chair, I can submit that we'll give it our best effort.
Okay, very good. All right, well, if there's no other questions, why don't we move on? Thank you both.
Mr. Chair and members, then, continuing on bottom of page R22, there's the Senate-only provision that prohibits private employers, which is a defined term, from requesting information regarding a non-conviction criminal record, which is also a defined term, from an employee or prospective employee, or obtain access to a non-conviction criminal record from another source, and also prohibits them from taking adverse actions against an employee or prospective employee based on a non-conviction criminal record. This only applies, though, to situations where a criminal background check is not specifically required under law or permitted under law. Subdivision 3 of that provides an affirmative defense for negligent hiring for an individual private employer who complies with the Subdivision 3 provision. And then there's a remedy provision if an individual is aggrieved by a private employer who does not comply with the law.
In fact, I understand there's some issues with this provision also, so maybe we should get that out on the table. Is someone from the administration that wants to address this section of the bill?
Mr. Chair, this is my bill, and again, it's been introduced. It's gone through a number of hearings. I'm the author. I haven't been contacted by the administration that they have an issue with this. I understand that the business community has some concerns. They have testified before both committees that this bill has gone before. But we try to work with this community to the extent that we can, but we've been able to take the business community's concerns, and that's why we're here. So,
I think someone from the governor's. Oh, I think someone from the governor's office is coming over here to address these issues. So we'll wait. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, somewhere here in my folder I have the language of the jobs that require the criminal background investigation, so we can get that copy so people know what's not in it.
Okay, very good. Mr. Backus, you want to continue?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Continuing on bottom of page R23, there's a Senate-only provision that basically changes an obscure, obsolete reference to the Public Safety Radio Planning Committee with the new statewide radio board term. Continuing on page R24, there's a Senate-only provision that under current law, the courts can accept credit cards for payments, but they're forbidden from charging convenience fees. This provision, later on, we repeal the current authority of the courts to accept credit cards, and here we reinstate that, but we also give them the right to impose these convenience fees, and the money that they collected would be appropriated to the level of court that collects the fee. Continuing then, bottom of page R24, there's the Senate and the House provision relating to military veterans who appear in court who are convicted of crimes. What the Senate does is it specifically requires when an defendant is appearing in court and convicted of a crime that the court has to inquire whether the defendant is a veteran or is in the military, and then if so, the court is authorized to take certain actions relating to treatment and things like that. The House and Senate positions are almost identical. The difference is specific. The Senate specifically requires the court to inquire as to whether the defendant is in the military. In the House, I think it's more implicit, and there's some technical differences as well. Beginning on page R25, Mr. Diebel mentioned this earlier. There's a similar provision. The Senate corrects on section 14 an obsolete reference to the Adult Offender Supervision Compact. With the current statutory reference. And then 15, 16, and 17 all relate to the Certificate of Good Conduct. 16 and 17 are conforming law changes. 15 is worth a quick note. It amends the expungement law, and it provides that a person can't petition for an expungement if the person has within the last 2 years petitioned either for an expungement or a certificate of good conduct. So essentially trying to have the person have an pick either remedy, but not both, within 2 years at least. And then there's the house-only provision on fireworks that Mr. Diebel can address.
Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, R27, there is Section 14, there's a house-only provision that deals with fireworks, and it increases the amount of chemical mixture permitted in non-explosive and non-aerial sparkling fireworks that are commonly referred to as multiple tubes, snakes, glowworms, smoke devices, or trick noisemakers. And I believe the intent of the author is to allow for existing legal fireworks to burn longer. They wouldn't be any more powerful other than that they would be allowed to have more chemical mixture, which would allow the people to enjoy them for longer periods of time.
Mr. Chair?
I'm hearing of it.
Did this get any hearing at all?
No, it was an amendment on the floor.
Okay.
We don't believe it. It didn't come into our committee, but it possibly could have gone to the policy committee. I don't believe so, though. It was an amendment by Representative Hackbarth on the House floor.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I don't believe it had a hearing in the Senate either.
Okay. Please go on.
Mr. Chair and members, on R28, there's a house-only provision. Section 15 contains two initiatives to be related. It requires the sheriff to run the name of a jail inmate through the state's predatory offender database to determine if the inmate is a registered predatory offender. If the inmate is a registered offender, the sheriff must inform the BCA that the offender is incarcerated. It does amend the current language in the statute to make for, currently is a gross misdemeanor if the sheriff does not comply with the statute, and it amends the standard from neglect to intentionally neglect to refuse to notify the BCA. I'm not aware of this ever being used to enforce compliance with the law. The second part of the section is it requires the sheriff to provide an incarcerated predatory offender with a change of information form upon the release for the purpose of ascertaining the offender's address once they are discharged from the jail. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Senate Counsel to close out the summary.
Mr. Beck. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Page R28 at the bottom, two Senate-only provisions that update language, strike language relating to solitary confinement and replace it with a more modern term, secure confinement. Page 29 and 30, there are two Senate-only provisions, Section 20 and 21, that are somewhat similar, both of which amend last year's public safety funding bill to strike rider language. Section 20 applies to the district courts and strikes language relating to their requiring them to maintain and establish drug courts. It doesn't lower the appropriation. It just gets rid of the requirement that they do that.
Mm-hmm.
Section 21 does similar things to the public defenders. There's specific language requiring them to hire a specific number of new attorneys and support staff. And the Senate's doing this because of anticipation of future budget cuts for these entities and to give more flexibility in allocating those cuts. Page R30, Senate Section 22 requires Commissioner Corrections to perform an internal review of the Department's guidelines for revocation of parole and supervised release. It specifies what, at the very minimum, they should look at and then report back to the legislature. Bottom of page R30, the Senate and House both have language requiring the state court administrators to convene a study group to consider the impact of a presumption of joint physical custody would be in Minnesota. There's some technical differences, the most notable of which is both the House and Senate require the court administrator to consult with specified legislators. The Senate's a little more broad in terms of who the court administrator would have to consult with. Section 17 on House side on page 31 and 25 on the Senate side requires the court administrator to report on a plan to conduct a multidisciplinary comprehensive study on family law. and they're nearly identical. The Senate requires the report also go to specified ranking members of the committees. Page R31 again, House Section 18, Senate Section 23, the Working Group on Controlled Substance Laws. Both bodies require this. The main difference is here is that the House requires basically the legislature, the Speaker of the House and the Senate Rules Committee to appoint all the members, where the Senate only has the legislature appointing some of them, and then some of them are appointed by the specific entities represented. The Senate also has, if you look on Clause 7 on Senate side, far right, 17.20, and compare it to the House, Senate has two individuals with relevant experience relating to sentencing policy or the criminal justice field, where the House only has one. The Senate also requires the group to come back, in addition to recommendations, with draft legislation, and then the House requires them to also essentially look at the application of certain current Minnesota laws, so there's a slight difference there. And there are other technical differences, but those are the main ones. But substantially, it's very similar. And then page R33, Senate Section 26, that's the appropriation for the Certificate of Good Conduct. The bill is, though, fiscally neutral, budget neutral, because the people who are paying for these, who are filing for these certificates, have to pay the civil filing fee, and that money is then appropriated to the courts and the Commissioner of Public Safety for their costs. And this only assumes that 50% will pay the fee. So, theoretically, if more people pay, there might be more money to the general fund. And then Section 27 is the Senate-only provision, which repeals a number of sections. It repeals the current authority of the courts to accept credit cards, which is superseded by the previous provision in the bill. And then it amends a number of sections, I think the Department of Corrections request relating to, relating to juvenile restitution and treatment grants that are no longer funded, and then outdated reporting requirements for juvenile placements. And Mr. Chair, that's it for the bill.
Mr. Backus, on the repealer on the out-of-home placement, we're not requesting that anymore? Is that the issue? And I thought that was a major issue that the legislature was grappling with, and I don't know why we turned them off.
Mr. Chair, this is a technical corrections bill that was brought to me by the department. Apparently, we don't fund those grants anymore. So that's why...
Senator Ma, I think we're speaking of two different things. There's the Juvenile Restitution Grant Program and the Juvenile Residential Treatment Grants. I understand that from DOC, but I'm asking about the repealer on the report from the Department of Human Services on the extent to which the goals of court-ordered out-of-home placement are being met. That's also...
Is that
Mr. Mayor?
Mr. Chair, Committee, my name is Ken Merge. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. And the reason that we've asked that report be repealed is, quite frankly, we have not been able to get the information necessary. Each year, we've only had been able to file a letter with you basically stating that we were not able to get the information as required from the courts, and therefore we had nothing to report. And it's been that way now for about 5 years that we have not been able to give you any substantial information. In fact, we have not since the beginning of that requirement of that report.
And why is that?
Each year we would send out the request to the courts, and we just don't get the information. We just don't get it back.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't the legislative auditors report when they studied out-of-home placements? I'm trying to remember the problems that this was trying to get at, and wasn't that a recommendation that they made?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer. I don't know for sure.
Is there anyone from the courts that maybe can shed some light on this and why we're not getting this information? Mr. Saul, do you know anything? Or?
Chair, members, my name is Sue DeSalle. I'm the State Court Administrator, and I just got in and got a snippet of it. It's something about out-of-home placement for juveniles. I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, we're appealing this report to the legislature, and I remember when we requested this back several years ago, and it sounds like they're having the DOC is having a difficult time getting this information from the court. And I'm wondering why.
I'd have to check, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to do that and get back to those corrections and to you.
Yeah, before we repeal it, I think we should find out why we never did it.
Okay.
Or maybe require the courts to give us the report rather than the other agency.
If you could look into that, Mr.
I will do that.
Thank you. Okay, so we have now. Can we revert back now to a couple of sections? First, if we can go back to Senator Mullis' provision and Mr. Lacombe, or can you explain what they were, Mr. Verde? The issue of. On the use of non-conviction records by private employers. So the administration issues with this or what? All right, so now Ms. Lacombe has informed me that the issue may not have been so much with the governor's office but with the business community. So is there anyone representing the business community that would like to address this section of the bill? I'm sorry, on page R22, this is the use of non-conviction records by private employers and the immunity from civil liability.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey was the National Federation of Independent Business, and we were involved a little bit with this in the Senate committee. I'm not an attorney, but from our standpoint, there's two practical problems, and you may hear more from others, but first of all, I guess to just pose a question to counsel or to the various counsels, what do we do with a situation where somebody can't work due to an arrest or a charged offense? They can't go to work. What would an employer do? And that's the practical thing. The person can't show up. They can't work. And you need to just keep them indefinitely. What you need to do, wait to the disposition of their case. The second thing is, what if a serious, violent, high-profile, or heinous crime? It would be very difficult for any business or organization, nonprofit or for-profit, to hang on to that person. And, you know, these are kind of the unusual case, but, you know, when you write a law, you got to look at all the factors. So what do you do with that person where it's a very serious, violent, heinous crime? Well, what do you do with that person? Just waiting the final disposition. Those are our two big concerns and a couple of questions I wanted to raise.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, at least in terms of the former question, if you look at the definition of non-conviction record on page R22, line 10.19, that is not pending. So it would be, you know, it would be something that's been kind of resolved in that sense. That it wouldn't be a pending charge against the person.
Mr. Hickey?
Mr. Chairman, if something was pending, would an employer be able to discharge a person then and not have a problem under this language?
Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, this provision only applies to non-conviction criminal records. So the prohibition on private employees taking those actions only relates to non-conviction criminal records. So if it's pending, it's not a non-conviction record.
Mr. Hickey?
I appreciate that. That's been kind of the concern is, but what can you do and what can't you do and where you draw the line.
Okay. Let's hear from the other testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrich with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I'd like to reiterate some of the assertions of Mr. Hickey. I apologize, I haven't looked at this bill in quite a while, so I'm reviewing my notes, but as a practical matter, I should just predicate all my remaining comments with this fact that most employers don't use non-conviction records in hiring decisions. Our attorneys have told us that that could possibly violate the Human Rights Act. And so therefore, they only review normally conviction records when making hiring decisions. So I should say that also, when this bill was originally introduced, we were neutral on it. It was not until later on in the process when the bill was amended into this current form that some red flags were raised with the chamber. A few of the concerns that we have were raised by Mr. Hickey, specifically preserving the jobs of people who have been arrested at the employer's expense, if the employer had actually started reviewing why an employee was not showing up to work. There was concern that an employer could be sanctioned under this section. At the same time, we believe this language prevents It also may place the workplace at risk, and I know this is an extreme example, but if an employee was jailed for terroristic threats involving the workplace, under Subdivision 2 of this section, an employer would face sanctions for even inquiring about the circumstances for taking action for such a threat or even removing an employee from the workplace. As for Subdivision 3, I'll skip through that. And as to Subdivision 4, depending on the court, actual damages may be more than just economic loss, which could be substantial as it relates to somebody's employment, and therefore it may be argued to include emotional harm. And then with the inclusion of attorney's fees also going one way, we believe this could inflate the value of weak claims. And so those are the current concerns that we have flagged, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative,
yep, I just had one comment about the we had this bill in as an informational hearing in a working group, and the only other concern that I don't know we ever received information back is the de novo program and whether this legislation would any way impede the people that were on the de novo program or how it would affect those actions. So I don't know if staff could address that.
Let's first, Mr. Backus, do you want to address, is it Dietrich?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dietrich's concern.
Mr. Chair, I did not hear his concern. I was talking to Mr. Diebel, I'm sorry.
Could you just restate your the issues again?
Sure, Mr. Chair. With Subdivision 2, our attorneys flagged some of the same concerns that Mr. Hickey had talked about. Basically, sanctioning employers when they would look into the circumstances for an employee not being at work because of an arrest. And then this was the extreme example that our attorneys gave us, but then again, that's what they do. They said it also may, this type of situation may place a workplace at risk if an employee was jailed for terroristic threats involving a workplace. And if that was the case, an employer under Subdivision 2 would be facing sanctions for even inquiring about the circumstances of such jailing and therefore taking action to remove the employee.
I think in both of those circumstances, the operative words in the section is criminal proceeding that is not pending. In both of those circumstances, it would be something that is actively going on, and so this would not affect that.
Mr. Backus,
Well, Mr. Chair, if the person is already hired and working, and if they're jailed, they can't be at work. And if the employer wishes, I mean, this is in the instance of looking to hire somebody. So I'm a little bit confused about the employee who is already hired by the employer. And if an employer is looking to hire somebody and it is a pending issue, the law does allow the employer to take that into consideration into the hiring process if that information should be disclosed in the interview process. But if it is not pending and did not result in a conviction in a prospective hire, that's when the employer would not use the non-conviction criminal record. So I guess I don't understand the instance where that Mr. Dietrich is bringing up about somebody who is employed and is somehow jailed.
Do Dick, do you want to respond to that?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members, and I might have to defer to counsel as I'm reading, trying to read through this again very quickly. And as a practical matter, with some of Senator Moss' comments, I would agree, and that goes back to the very first statement that I made when I began my testimony, and that was regarding that most employers don't use non-conviction records in employing are making hiring decisions. But if you look at line 10.22 under subdivision 1.3, it says private employer means a person hiring, and then there's an or that says employing individuals in this state. And so I'm guessing that when our attorneys flagged this, that they were concerned about that second portion of the statement after the word or when it goes into an employment decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I do think, Representative Moore, that it does relate to employees. It's not only prospective employees. I mean, that is pretty clear from the language on 10.28. Mm-hmm. You can't get request information regarding a non-conviction criminal record from an employee or a prospective employee, but that said, I still don't think it's a problem because of the way the because of the definition that was read before, and also this whole section only relates to getting records. It doesn't relate to any sort of employer sanction against an employee who just isn't there, as the Senator is saying. So even though current employees, Senator, are included in this just by the language, but I still think that the concern is unfounded because there's nothing in here that either prevents an employer from looking into a current arrest situation, because that's not part of the definition here, or from sanctioning an employee who just doesn't show up to work for whatever reason. So I think those concerns really are not, I think they're just really unfounded from the language of this bill.
Do you want to...
sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to read through this.
Mr. Chair?
Senator,
while he's looking through that, maybe somebody can clear this up for me, too, but on line 10.28, request for information, is this in the form of a formal or application or informal conversation? Have you been in trouble with a law type question? And the other question I would have would be obtaining access. I mean, in the smaller communities, a lot of times the newspaper articles and what like will put arrested subjects as well as convicted subjects. Is that something there, or somewhat ambiguous as far as obtaining access in line 29 there? Somebody can answer that.
Senator Moss?
Mr. Chair, I believe that this question was asked in committee. Ms. Pontius is the other counsel of the committee who is not here, whose area is, remember that this is paired after current law that applies to public employers. Public employers currently are already doing this, okay? So we're just extending to the private employers what public employers are currently doing. And in that conversation when this question was asked last time, of course employers will come into information, but the intent here is that they may not use that information. So yes, I mean, it will be, you know, different arrests happened all the time, and in small communities I think that would be the case, but it's my intent that if they do come to that information, and the non-conviction criminal record should meet the definition in the statute, that then they would not use that information.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on this provision? Do you have anything else that you would want to say, Mr. Dietrich? I guess we have them. Maybe you could put your concerns in writing with some more concrete examples, and we can... Let's still take a look.
Well, sure, Mr. Chair, and I know that there's some other members of ours that have specific concerns as it relates to their industry, and I'll try to flag them to way as well.
Yeah, if you could get those to us as soon as possible, that would be good.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a question?
I'm just trying to think of a situation where this would be an issue. What I do outside of the legislature is we manage property for a number of owners. And one of the services that we either contract out to provide or provide ourselves is cleaning and we're in tenant premises oftentimes as the property manager. And if we were hiring for a kind of a low level entry position cleaning person, and someone came and applied, and it was kind of common knowledge around that they had an issue with rumor theft, that kind of thing. Would we be required to hire them if they met all of the criteria for the job, and then have them represent us when they're going into tenant spaces and cleaning? And even though it's a hearsay thing, it has a pretty big impact on the employer if an individual comes and applies for a job. Even though there may not be anything pending or on their record, there may be lots of anecdotal information in a small community about how reputable a particular person is and the kind of activities they've been involved in. That's my question. What would this do as an employer wanting to fill that position? Would I be required to hire that person?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Lanning.
Eastland.
Sorry. Line 10.25 specifically says, unless a criminal background investigation is specifically required or permitted by law, a private employer must not. So it's my understanding that in a lot of housing situations, housing management groups, and this was vetted with, I think, the housing management group. They were comfortable with that language because what that says is that if you're required or particularly in the housing setting, in the hire of management, you subject them, the law requires and permits you to subject them to a background check through that process, then this doesn't apply to you as a private employer. Now, if you don't fall into the category, as a private employer, if you don't fall into the category where a criminal background investigation is specifically required or permitted by law, and you choose to exercise discretion in terms of the kind of information that you take in, I guess that's where you, this would apply to you, and you would have to consult your lawyer on whether or not you ought to be exercising those types of discretions, because I don't know whether this law passes or not. I don't know if I would be comfortable exercising those types of discussions based on rumors and innuendos anyway.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in a small community, a lot of things are communicated by rumors. I mean, and there's a lot of common knowledge that occurs and things that happen. If you've ever lived in a small community, I think you'd be aware of what I'm talking about. But there's individuals who have had kind of a record, and they've kind of gotten the benefit of the doubt over and over and over again. In my situation, we do commercial property. We're not doing housing. We're not in that arena. But we have to have people who are very, very, very trustworthy. And if people are not trustworthy based on the community's impression and their past experience, even though they haven't been convicted of something, I don't know if this is something I hadn't thought of up until now, but I don't know if this, the issue that we're talking about right here would actually, put an employer in a position where they were, they would have to hire somebody, or they would have to proceed and hire somebody that maybe would have a detrimental effect on their business, just on their own integrity, because they would have an individual that would be representing them in situations that could be very compromising. So I think that's where I'm kind of coming from, and just looking at it. If that's what this says, I'm not sure, and that's my question.
Well,
Senator
Mr. Chair, the definition of non-conviction criminal record means a record of an arrest, citation, complaint, prosecution, or other records relating to criminal proceedings. It doesn't say innuendos and rumors and community rumors and, you know. So, I mean, I think that the law says what kind of record, what kind of non-conviction criminal record you use. I guess we would have to go back to see what that says, and I'm not seeing innuendos and community rumors in there.
Okay.
Sure. Yes.
If I may, if it's appropriate, just to respond a little bit further to what Representative Eastland was talking about. Those were some of the other concerns. I had a chance to finish reviewing my notes that we did hear from some of our other members, particularly the ones that were not specifically required or permitted by law to conduct background checks that would include non-conviction arrest records. Let's say, for instance, you're a hotel, you're hiring a night manager. There was concerns that if an individual had been arrested but not convicted, and therefore then all of a sudden they had access to room keys where potential clients would be staying. We've also heard from either security systems or companies that go in and install things like landlines or DSL connections or different types of phone lines that if, again, a person did not receive a conviction but was arrested for offenses that may be related to breaking and entering or robbery or something of that matter, that there would be concern, again, giving that person access to a house. And finally, under, and I'm sorry I didn't flag this earlier, but it's related to this section on line 10.29, when it talks about reviewing that non-conviction criminal records for employees. And again, this is an extreme example, but we were also told that a lot of times that local community newspapers, when they are distributed, oftentimes in the back pages, oftentimes publish different types of incidents that have occurred in the communities relating to crime, and that, let's just say you're an employer and all of a sudden you have that thrown on your desk, and maybe in an interview situation it relates to the person in front of you, when it talks about obtaining access to a non-conviction criminal record, that could qualify under this language.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman, interested to hear the comments he makes, I just would like to say that I clearly don't believe that that an individual who is arrested and not convicted should have any kind of record and should allow various people in the process to have records showing that he or she committed a crime when it didn't happen. And those are the folks that we're having trouble with as far as the convictions are concerned, because it doesn't get out of the class. There was an incident here in St. Paul a few years back where an individual got involved in that with the identity part of it, and the issue there is such that we hold presumption of innocence, and until we're convicted, I think all of this use of data and so forth should be adhered to.
Senator Foley, I'm sympathetic to this and the provision.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, I do support the aim, and I wasn't directing my remarks to the side-by-side or any other documents we're having. I was just talking about the statement of the witness there that clearly is talking about some kind of country that I'm not supporting.
Mr. Giebel, what's on lines 10.20, when we're looking at non-conviction criminal records, so what kinds of criminal offenses, I don't know if that would be under 15.152.18, but when the court is staying the sentence or deferring, if there's a deferral of a conviction, I mean, what kinds of possible criminal offenses?
I don't have the statute in front of me, but it's low-level drug offenses. I think it's, I could look like fourth, fifth, third-degree possession cases, things like that, where you don't really have a prior. We could get more details, but we usually say it's those low-level drug possession cases.
Is that 15.18? All right, any other questions, comments? Or would you like to testify on this?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Hazzi. I work, I'm a staff attorney at the Council on Crime and Justice.
The counsel, our former president, Tom Johnson, former Hennepin County attorney, has worked closely with Senator Mu in authoring this legislation. I just wanted to bookend my statement with a expression we should all be familiar with, which is innocent until proven guilty. And this just goes to this whole issue that was brought up with the certificate of good conduct, that we have a real problem here, and it's, you know, call it a human rights problem or call it a public safety problem. Some studies say that about 21% of our population in general has some kind of a criminal record. And since 2001, employers, back in 2001, about roughly 30% of employers did background checks on their employees or prospective employees, and today it's somewhere around 80%. So the public safety issue is that the people with records, and I've, you know, since I've started my job at the council, I've met with people trying to get them funds and dealing with the roadblocks. You know, if they don't get a job, what are they going to do? And it's also been found that employment is the number one way to reduce recidivism. So that's just sort of the public policy statement. I also wanted to, you know, make sure that some of the law here is really clarified. And as Senator Mua said, this bill has been carefully crafted. It's gone through a couple of Senate hearings. We've made some changes after it was heard in the House also. And it's really, I believe, a fairly narrow construction to try and do something about this issue. A couple things. I think you all got a memo that looks like this that covers some of the points in the bill, but that does address some of the issues that were brought up. The definition of non-conviction criminal record is very important because it does not include a process that is proceeding. So the legitimate concern that the business community has about what if an employee disappears, you can't ask him where he was. Well, that's a pending proceeding, so you could ask him and ask him about what happened with the arrest. The other, the last portion of that non-conviction criminal record definition was put in there because of Representative Bingham's concern about, I believe it was the DeNoble program. If somebody has either a stay of adjudication, which is considered a non-conviction normally for a low-level drug offense, or a diversion to a drug program, employers can ask about that. And that makes sense because employers, if somebody has, you know, has had a drug problem, and even if it was the first time, that's something that they should be aware of. As Senator Mua mentioned, there already is a law that prohibits public employers from using arrest records in hiring. And as was also brought up, there's a whole list on the back of this memo of all the statutes that already require or permit employers to use arrest records, and that, you know, oftentimes we hear, what about volunteers in the schools, or what about people working with vulnerable adults or children? Those are all accepted from this statute. So again, this is a very, you know, narrowly tailored a bill. And then there hasn't been a lot of discussion so far about the second part of this, these two sections, which is subdivision 3, affirmative defense. I want to make, sometimes there's some confusion about this, but that affirmative defense does apply to conviction records also. So what that means is, currently there's negligent hiring liability law, so if an employer hires somebody and doesn't adequately do a background check, then that person commits some violent crime on the workplace, they can be held liable. All this does is say, it says that if the employer, when they hired that person, they found that, and this is really similar to the public employer statute, if they found that that prospective employee, their record does not relate to the type of work they're doing, or they've been rehabilitated, they can use that as an affirmative defense, meaning that if they get sued, that's when they can bring that up at the beginning of the lawsuit, and it may help them mitigate liability a little bit, but they could still be subject to the lawsuit. And then I just wanted to mention a couple other things around the support for this. At some of the other hearings in the Senate, one of our board members of the council, Tom Boardman, he's a vice president of human resources at 3M, he testified, and he testified that 3M does not use arrest records, and many other companies don't. And I know that Mr. Dieterich said that most employers don't use arrest records. I think most is the operative word. I don't know how many do or don't, and I don't think he does. There have been EEOC statements that have said employers should not use arrest records initially in hiring people because it has a disparate impact on communities of color, because communities of color have a disparate, there are a proportion of communities of color that have arrest records. So that's true, but there are employers out there that do use arrest records when they shouldn't, and I think this law would bring attention to that and make that clear. And then another concern that was brought up by the business community was this high-profile criminal case. And I've heard that. What about O.J. Simpson? What about John Gotti? You know, an employer can still use, an employer is not prohibited from checking into the overall background of an employee. They can, they still can and should use references, work history, and those types of things. So, you know, I think, the hypothetical person that's been hanging out on the street corner selling drugs and just getting arrested and not getting convicted, well, I wonder what their work history would look like and what kind of references they would have. So I think the employer does have some protections around that. And another person that testified in the Senate was Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman. He came out in favor of these provisions. So in summary, I ask for your leadership. I think it's a small move forward in this area, but I think because of the statistics I cited at the beginning, it's a really important area. And once again, innocent until proven guilty. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other questions?
Yeah, could I just make one other comment and maybe ask another question? I don't disagree with this provision, but I guess I do think we ought to look really closely when we're gonna just wrap a requirement on the private sector, even though maybe we have done it in the public sector for quite a while. And I guess just to maybe kind of follow through here, this is my question. This is how it comes out in line 1019. If you look on 1019, it says non-conviction criminal record means a record of an arrest, citation, complaint, prosecution, or other record. I don't know what that is, but other record is just kind of a broad. It picks up anything else that might occur. Relating to a criminal proceeding. Okay, then when you go to 1025, it says the use of a non-conviction record for private employment. Unless the criminal background investigation is specifically required or prohibited by law or permitted by law, a private employer must not. I mean, they must not. I mean, so it's a pretty significant thing. And then if you look over on line 1031, it says they must not take adverse action against an employee or prospective employee based on the non-conviction criminal record. So, I mean, if there's some information out there, it seems like other records, if there's some information out there, whatever kind it is, it seems like they must not use that in an employment determination. And I guess that is a little bit concerning to me. It's kind of putting a pretty heavy hand on what a private employer can do. And there's some things that matter. I mean, if I'm hiring somebody to mow grass, I mean, I'm not going to be as concerned about the fact that maybe he doesn't have the greatest reputation in the community. But if we're looking for somebody to do something and they've got some anecdotal information, and I use that kind of loosely, and I think if you live in a small community, you know what I mean. There's a lot of kids, the young people who get the benefit of the doubt. You know, maybe they've had a few encounters with drugs, and maybe they've had a few minor thefts around the community, and they've never really been prosecuted on those issues. But people know it, and you want to help them, and you have a job that might require a little more integrity, and you're concerned about it, and they apply, and they're the only ones that apply. My question is, according to this, we don't have any rights not to hire them. And that may be a kind of an exception in the case, but I guess that if you take the letter of this, it looks to me like that's what this is saying, and that's a concern to me.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to respond to that, because frankly, if I'm an employer, I won't have any trouble making a decision whether a person is going to be hired or not. And I think that employment at will is pretty established in the employment sector, and I don't see any concern for what you're talking about. So I would ask for recognition on that, Mr. Chair.
Again, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little bit confused about... I thought we had answered this question already earlier when I talked about the fact that the other
record relating to a criminal proceeding that is not pending and did not result in a conviction. And so, it really is based on arrests and citations, complaints, and, you know, other records relating criminal proceedings that is not pending and did not result in a conviction. I don't know how this somehow would cover, again, the things that you've talked about.
I guess they're just concerns that I have whenever we start to lay over requirements onto the private sector that, I think sometimes we should think twice about regulating.
Very good. If there's no more discussion on that, let's revert back to the other section that we waited for Ms. Bigham to be here, so she could discuss some of the issues on page R4. On the sex offenders having access or using the social networking website.
Right.
Maybe Senator Moore, do you want you were the one that brought up the definition? It's your bill and Bigham's bill, but maybe you'd like to explain the issues that are outstanding for you.
Mr. Chair, and members, there are two bills involved, I believe, and they're all kind of cut up and interspersed throughout. But one is the an agency bill. And the other one, the social networking bill, I believe was brought to us by the Attorney General's office. And the bill that was brought to us by the Attorney General's office is the social networking website bill. I care a lot about, you know, this whole area with cyberspace and what we're doing with it. But when the Judiciary Committee had an opportunity to think this over, the issue that Senator Higgins raised was the very reason why we had some concerns that we need a little bit more time to really look at the enforceability and to look at the mechanics of the social networking bill. So that one didn't get a hearing. But the department's bill, we did try to give a hearing. And as I was presenting the bill, I think that a number of questions were raised from members of the Judiciary Committee who were very concerned about aspects of it. And we just ran out of time to give it the proper amount of hearing and airing that we needed to. And so we went past the deadline and didn't have a chance to come back. My sense is that if it weren't so late, if we had an opportunity to bring it back, I think that the members would have, you know, may have come to a place where we might be able to do something with it. So I'm not, again, these are my bills, and I would like us to have an opportunity to talk about it. But in terms of the social networking website bill, we did make the intentional effort to hold off on that because of the amount of work that it would take. And I did feel comfortable bringing forward the department bill. So, Representative Bigham, we talked about this, so.
I'm confused now. There's the two bills that you're talking about. The one is the, is using the internet, the networking, networking website. Which bill is that? Is that the department bill?
That's the agency, the Attorney General's bill.
That's the AG's bill. And is that the one you wanted more time on, or is it the other?
Yes, that's the one that we intentionally did not hear in the committee because we did not, we felt that that was something that needed to be worked on and worked on a little bit longer because there were some ongoing issues. The one that we did bring to the committee for hearing was the department's bill.
And that's what?
The predator offender address verification.
Okay.
One.
That one you're okay with. That one's all right.
Yeah.
That's good.
Thank you, Chair Fehmarr. And we have spoke about this. The only thing I would say is this went through a couple of hearings and received relatively no debate on the floor when the amendments were put on. And, the enforcement side of this, Senator Moore, is that there's allowed to have the warrantless search of a person's of a registered predator, their computer and electronic devices. So that's part of the enforcement. The other part is the industry side of it. So could it use more work? I would probably be remiss to say that there isn't room to maybe encompass a little bit more. I mean, I think in anything committee that we had some questions about from Representative Less about other online gaming type things. You know, if you're playing online Scrabble and you're chatting with somebody, he wanted to take a look at those kinds of things too and whether this would actually fall under that. So, I mean, I think that it's a good bill, it's a strong bill, and maybe, you know, we can work on some of it next year, but I still personally would like to continue going forward with it. On the other, on the agency bill, to me, this is, there's no fiscal note on it, and it is just, in my opinion, a very good way to weed through some of the non-compliant registrants. If they come through a county jail or a local jail or a, to be able to be checked on a registry, I just think that that is a very, very common sense thing. And, you know, it's again, an agency bill, and all 87 sheriffs have access to this. And we've moved it on to make sure that prior to release, if they don't have an address, they have to notify the local agency if they're going to be being released. And there's some other things in the bill that I just think are very good. And I don't see an issue with them. There's been no testimony to the contrary on it.
Senator Bigham, I think Senator Morrissey was fine with that one being included in the bill, I said.
Yeah, I was just explaining how good the bills are, yeah. Mr. Chair.
We heard that. We heard that on the House.
I changed my mind.
Representative Lieberman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I do have a question about the second piece here with the 5 days before the person is released.
Can you give us the page?
I'm on page R4, and it's line 3.3 to 3.7. And the question I have is just the practical implementation of this. I'm fully on board with the need to do it, but I'm wondering, as I understand it, you know, there are some penalties, of course, for not registering, for not complying with this, and I just wonder if there's any information about whether it's really totally within a person's control if they're in the correctional facility. You know, do they have the ability themselves to register when they want to register? That would be my concern.
Thank you. There's a provision in there that the jail or county facility would have to provide them with a form upon release to do so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't know if Representative Bingham misspoke, but upon release, see, this is saying at least 5 days before the person's release, they have to actually register. So, you know, they have to give their address or say where they're going to be. So giving them a form upon release wouldn't help, and I would hope that something would be made available to them beforehand, and if it isn't, that they would have some protection against the sanctions that would go along with not registering.
Okay. That's if the 5 days prior to release is if they know, like if they are being like in a an intermediate facility, as far as like maybe a, I'm drawing a blank to the name, halfway house or I forget the term, but if they know exactly where they're going upon release because it's been worked out through their probation, that's the point of that. If they are homeless, which is maybe somebody that you know that you're referring to in a situation that you're referring to, they have to then register with the city of where they're going to be heading to. That's the concept. And the department is in here too if they'd like to answer some questions.
Can someone clarify this somehow?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Regarding the homeless provision and the five-day aspect of Representative Leaving, the intent there is to give law enforcement and Department of Corrections, I believe, an opportunity to do the notification and so on if it's a level three, that type of practical effect of this. So what it would do is when someone is in confined and 5 days before they're going to be released, they need to notify us of where they intend to go. That could certainly change, but at least that would be the starting point. And if something changes in that meantime, then they would update it just as they always would. But at least at 5 days, they have to say, if they're going to be homeless, they have to say, I intend to go to Rochester, Minnesota. Okay? And then they have to, then we can deal with that and start playing for it, rather than as they walk out the door to say, in 24 hours, I'll let you know where I end up.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Superintendent O'Malley, I understand that part, and I have no problem with any of what you're saying. My only question relates to just the practical aspect of the person being able to do that 5 days before they're released. And maybe this is something that someone from the DOC really should address, because I just want to know, since we know that there are penalties that attach to not complying with the law with regard to these things, I want to make sure that the people who this is going to apply to will have the ability to physically do the registration. You see where I'm going with this? So that we don't get people in an unintended cycle here because they physically didn't have it in their control to do this. Because obviously when they're in custody, you know, they don't always have the ability to physically do the things that you or I could do.
Superintendent O'Malley, we do have someone from some people from DOC to answer that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Crist. I am the Assistant Commissioner for the Facilities Division of the Department of Corrections. Representative Liebling, our caseworkers work hand in glove with the BCA right now to enable all of our offenders who need to notify the BCA where they're going to be going to have access to that. The case managers really dog the offenders to get that information from them so that we can get that to the BCA, and we would do that in compliance with this provision.
All right, Sam.
In the fiscal note that we were all given, I see that we have five beds a year prison bed impact. And I can't really tell on page 11 of the fiscal note whether they come from the social networking website provision or from the homeless provision. If somebody could maybe tell us that would be useful. Either way, we probably have to pay for these five beds in this bill or in our other bill. Oh. Is there somebody from DOC who can tell us about that, please?
Mr. Chair, members.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry, I'm Chris Dodge. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Corrections. And that part of the fiscal note pertains to the provision of the bill regarding the civil commitment. If you look at the third bullet.
Mr. Dodge, are you looking on page 11 of 16?
No, I'm looking at our fiscal notes, page 2 of 3.
Okay, the third bullet.
Actually, the first three bullets. Senator Higgins, I believe what you were looking at is a draft of the fiscal note from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission?
That's correct.
Right, and that's not the DOC.
Okay.
But that impact, like I said, it's due to the provisions of the bill regarding sex offenders provides that sex offenders held with civil commitment can choose to be held at a DOC facility instead of at a DHS treatment center.
Held at the county rather than at the DOC. Okay, now I know what provision you're talking about. Thank you.
Okay.
I just want to, Mr. Dodge, because we seem to remember that when the Department of Corrections testified at our committee that there wouldn't be a cost.
In previous fiscal notes, we have always identified that impact for those. And sentencing guidelines have also indicated that there would be a bad impact.
Mr. Chair? I think in the language, though, it says that DOC would be reimbursed by either Human Services or the county. Isn't that correct, Mr. Carter? Shaking your head.
Senator Higgins, Chairman Seymour, that is correct. The Department of the provisions of this bill would give us the authority to bill the counties for that, and we would collect revenue to offset those costs.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, we don't have to pay for that then, as you just said.
Senator Higgins, that is correct.
Thank you. It took me a long time to get there, but thank you.
How does the revenue that's flowing from the counties, how is that accounted for? I mean, is that at what rate are they billing counties for? If counties could house these people cheaper, but now they don't house them and they're paying, how does that work? What's the net impact on counties, I guess is my...
Senator, or Mr. Chair, Senator, or Representative Jacob?
Eastman,
sorry. We don't know the net impact on counties. The DOC would bill our current per diem rate at the time. I don't know, I don't have the data, though, on what that difference would be between our per diem and what DHS would charge them. But I think it would be relatively significant.
Mr. Chair, if I remember correctly, and that's always an iffy question, but I believe the counties are now being charged at the MSOP rate, the sex offenders, so at 300 and something, and it would be now at something under 100.
Right, Mr. Chair, our per diem currently is right around $90.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Dodge. Senator Ball.
Mr. Chair, as we're kind of wrapping up, there's one more issue that we haven't talked about. I wonder if I could refer to that. It's the presumption and joint custody study language that was in here. I had some concerns that may or may not have a fiscal impact, but Mr. Chair, because having been a member of the conference committee for the Bridge Compensation Committee, now that we're going to no longer need that language, I don't think, because I fully intend to sign the conference committee report. If that language comes out, I think the rest of the bill is really criminal related. And so as we're walking through this, it triggered in me that if we keep that study language in here, whether or not we would be treading on single subject issues too. So I just want to raise that for the committee to talk about. But I think we should hear from the courts about whether or not the study itself would trigger a fiscal impact.
unless you're not interested.
No, I'm fine. I understood that we asked the court that question. They said that they could absorb it, but if Ms. Marshall's here or Ms. Solis is here.
I wasn't aware of that, so they don't have to come up if they don't want to.
Well, let's just verify it, Ms. Marshall. Is there a cost to this? And this is something that I know that I think the court has been wanting to do some research on. And no? I don't know. Ms. Marshall, is there a cost to this? Or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. In terms of doing this piece just about presumed joint custody, we are hoping to find some volunteers from the law school who will do a lot of the research for us. So therefore, there would be no cost if we're able to, do that. And as long as it's kept very narrow in scope.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was my concern is that, and I did raise this when Senator Tossman brought this up, is that in conversations, you know, I sat in the, Representative Mueller and I sat on a working group this summer, too, to focus on this issue. And we didn't bring the group's recommendation forward because in conversations with the court, they were going to try to get volunteers to do this work. I'm concerned that if we require them to do it and to report back to us, and if they can't get the volunteer efforts to do the work, you know, where does that put them since they're already trying to do that? So I raised the concern that maybe we ought to let them try to do the work that they're planning to do without requiring it in statute, just giving some flexibility. But it's up to the committee members to decide that. My personal preference is that if they're already intending to do this, I'd much rather not put the mandate on them on the off chance that they can't get the volunteer individuals to do the work. And then the other issue is the single subject issue, if that is a concern or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think regarding the single subject issue, if you look at the language there on line 17.16 and 19.21, part of the people that are involved are domestic violence advocates. I mean, I think domestic violence is clearly a criminal activity, and I think it would have some application to the subject that we're talking about in the bill. I think it's an appropriate place for this bill.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that we didn't really talk about in the Senate, and this was a floor amendment in the Senate, and it was not heard in any committees. There's a whole list of people who are to be on the study group, but I remember that Senator Berglund was very passionate in her speaking against this because of the issues in human services and the cost of the presumption of joint physical custody to the human services side, and I don't see anybody on the list who would represent that very practical group that we need to have information from. And I think it's Ms. Marshall, the chair, but Senator Moore passed out something from the courts on the floor as well, saying that the courts were going to be bringing this issue forward next year, asking for funding to do a study like this. Did I remember that correctly, Ms. Marshall, or Senator Moore?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, as part of our FY 2010-11 strategic plan, we would like to initiate a huge multidisciplinary study in the whole area of family law and how to make the outcomes better for children and family and much more effective. And that would end up coming in next year as part of our budget request.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Marshall, do you have any guess of what you would be asking for in terms of funds to do that comprehensive study?
Ms. Marshall.
You can just guess.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, usually a study like that would be somewhere in the range of $200,000 for staff and research.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Marshall, that's basically the Section 25 in the Senate, Section 17 in the House side. That's That's the paragraph that states that you would do that report by January instead, without any fine. Can you talk to us a little about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I think what it asks us to do is to come back and report on how much a big study would cost. And we have to report back on that by January.
I didn't say this last time, but I wanted to thank the committee for allowing me time to get here to go over my provisions. I first wanted to say that I appreciate your indulgence. The second thing, I don't know if this is a drafting error, Mr. Chair, but on 17.6, it says the state court administrator shall convene a study group. Then it says 17.13, it says in appointing members to the study group. And unless I'm missing something, it doesn't say who appoints them, it just says who's convening them. So I don't know if that was a drafting error or just as far as when the four amendments came on, but I think it's important that we figure out who is going to be appointing members to a study group, and that's just what I'd like to point out. And I don't know if we should, I believe it's Senator Salzman and Representative Mahoney, and we should consult with them just to see on exactly their wording and their intent.
So you're questioning and Representative Bigham who's appointing?
Again, Mr. Chair, it says on the first line, it says the state court administrator shall convene a study group, but unless there's an assumption that who's ever convening it also does the appointing, but you know, usually we have the governor appoint or we have the commissioner of whatever department appoint. So unless it's an oversight or unless there's different requirements, I'm just bringing this to the attention. It's that one says convene and one says and the next one says in appointing members.
I think the intent was that the state court administrator would do that, but we can get that clarified.
In the Senate, all of these study groups and task forces are supposed to go through state and local government committee, and Senator Ralph, who's the chair of that, has a form, a detailed form that you have to have. As a form, a detailed form that you have to bring forward with your bill telling you all of those details. Who's going to appoint? Are they going to be paid per diem? Are there going to be legislators? Will they be getting a per diem? All of those kinds of things. And it's kept us from a lot of trouble, I think, in these odd study groups that are a little nebulous, like Representative Bingham said.
Well, I think those working groups are from this branch of government and not the judiciary, which is fairly in control over. So. But we can get some clarity on that.
That's a good point, too, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I do have a couple of handouts, and the brief point I want to make today is that we do object to the provision that changes the allowable amount of explosives and legal fireworks in Minnesota. And we've had some significant discussions about the whole fireworks issue within our policy committee group, and we've heard from a number of city officials that the fireworks that are allowed right now have caused a lot of problems for local law enforcement when they're trying to respond to calls, and that they have been disruptive in neighborhoods, and for that to expand at all would be troubling for the folks that have to do the enforcement. And I do have our position in writing, and I did also want to mention that I printed off a form from the page of the state fire marshal's report that does show that injuries and property damage is up as a result of the repeal of the ban on fireworks, and that does concern us, and I would hope you would consider that information when you decide if you'll keep this provision to go.
Thank you, Ms. Sennett. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Ms. Finn could address the issue that has been raised that really it's not a safety issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, I've not heard that. We've not been approached by whoever it is who's advocating this legislation. I don't know who that is, but I can't understand how it would improve safety if it's actually more flammable material in the fireworks that are legal. If there's a good explanation for that, I'd like to hear it too.
Representative Hackbarth, do you want to maybe Ms. Finn has... No, stay there, Ms. Finn. You can stay there. I just thought with Ms. Finn from the league has raised concerns about your bill, and as long as you're here, at least that maybe you'd like to address them.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what the question or the concern was. I can explain the issue, but if I heard what the question was.
Ms. Finn, can you just briefly say it again?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Representative Hackbarth, Senator Moore was just asking about information that he's heard that this would actually make the fireworks that are legal in Minnesota more safe. And I've not heard that.
So can you, Ms. Finn, can you say what your objections to the bill, to this provision are?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, the League has long opposed legalization of fireworks, and we've heard from city officials in the meetings that we've held at the League and throughout the state that they have had difficulty enforcing the fireworks laws that do exist on the books in Minnesota. And just to expand on that a little bit, folks have had a difficult time determining what is legal. There have been neighbors, residents, and communities that have considered these a nuisance, and it's generating what they think are an excessive amount of police and fire calls to neighborhoods.
Yeah. Representative Hackbarth, you want to respond?
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Mull, I don't know of anyone that said that. I have not said that this provision actually makes the fireworks safer. I don't think that's an issue at all. I don't know where that came from. I don't know. But I've not been saying that, and I don't know of anybody that has been saying that, so I don't know who told you that makes them safer. I don't think that's the issue, though. All this provision in this bill does is make the existing fireworks that we have in the state of Minnesota. It doesn't make them louder, it doesn't make them taller, it doesn't make them go boom or anything like that. It just simply makes them last longer. It's the same exact thing that we have now. They've been around now for, what, 3 or 4 years? And members, I don't know of any opposition to this bill. I've talked to people with the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association. There's no opposition to this provision. I know these folks were in and campaigning against the bill when we first passed it back in 2003, I think it was, but there's literally been no problem with the Minnesota fireworks that we made legal in the state of Minnesota. The issue that we're talking about here with the problem that we're having with fireworks are not the Minnesota fireworks. It's the fireworks that are being brought in from other states. It's the bottle rockets that shoot up in the air and go boom, and the Roman candles and those kinds of things that do shoot up and they land someplace and they're still hot and they start a fire in a grassy area, for example. Members, I've been on Oak Grove Fire Department for 25 years, and I can tell you that since this law went into effect, we've not had any problem with this provision, none whatsoever. None of these fireworks have been starting any grass fires. You can check with the state fire marshal's office. This is not the problem. It's the ones that shoot in the air and might land in a field of dry grass someplace, and those start fires. And I've been to many of those grass fires and wildland fires that were created that way. And I agree, we shouldn't be doing that. But this provision, members, just simply makes what we have legal in Minnesota last longer. It doesn't do anything more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have talked with somebody who actually
has explained to me quite well how much safer they are, actually, because of the spacing requirements would be with the new versus the existing product. Actually, the spacing of the tubes, of the pyrometrics that are involved.
Really?
Yes, as well as, it was explained to me that if you were going to have a 15-minute display, that it would be safer in the fact that you have five tubes being ignited at one time versus three or two, so you'd have less igniting going on. And I think that's where you actually have most of the injuries, is when you ignite these things. So it seems like a thing in the right direction.
I didn't know that myself, so I think that's a big plus.
That's a big plus. Representative Levine.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hackbarth, I mean, you said that you haven't heard any opposition to this, but I think your opposition is sitting right next to you there.
Mm-hmm.
But this went pretty fast on the House floor, and I must say, I don't have a good understanding of, you know, really what you're trying to do here. I mean, the changes from 200 to 500 grams for multiple tube snakes and glowworms, and I mean, I guess I just ask you to explain, you know, why 200 to 500? What is the substance that you're allowing more of? And the specific concern that I would have is if, as you're saying, this is just something that makes it last longer, I would think that lasting longer would increase the risk of igniting a fire. So could you please address that?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Liebling, you take one unit, and some of the units are small, and some of them are a little bit larger, and they have tubes with the ignition powder in there, if you want, or the chemical. And what the bill does is just allow each one of the units, each tube can only have a maximum amount of the substance in it, each tube. So if you have three tubes or four tubes, each tube can only have so much in a tube. So this would allow more tubes to be connected to one unit, so it would, as they go off, it just makes them last longer. Each tube can only have so much of the substance in it, but as you add tubes, it makes them last longer.
Thank you for that, Representative Hackbarth. But then the second part of the question then is, you know, how can this not then at least somewhat increase the risk of injury or fire, because you're doing more of it, you're making it last longer, and more chance it can come in contact with something flammable or that you can stick it in your eye or whatever. Could you please address that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think that if a family gets together and you're going to ignite one of these things, you usually buy more than one, and there's a number of them, so you're going to be setting a lot of them off anyway. You try to do it in a safe, contained area, maybe on a gravel driveway or something like that. That's what we do at my house. We've got a gravel driveway, and that's where we ignite them. And they just park over, and they don't go any distance whatsoever. And you usually ignite them in a safe area anyway. You're not doing it out in a grassy field where it's going to start something on fire. So I think even if you just do one small firework, you'd have the same potential if you had one, or if you had many, or if you had one that lasted longer. I think you have the same potential.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to take up all the time here, but just one other little question, too, is, you know, where is this coming from? I mean, I understand what you'd like to do, but, I mean, is there, you know, are the manufacturers asking for this, or who exactly is asking for it?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's who's asking for it, the people that make the fireworks. You've seen these booths, these tents that are up in like at Walmart or at Cub Foods, they sell these things right before 4th of July. Those are the folks that are asking for this. It's another unit that they can sell. It's a little bit bigger product that they can sell at these different tents.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I have a copy of the flyer that the lobbyists came by.
Okay.
And clearly, they do try to say that it is safer. So, for better or for worse, there are people saying that this is safer. We did get a phone call from the Minneapolis Police Department, Fire Department this morning, saying that they're opposed to it.
Mr. Chair, and if I could just add one comment.
I don't think universally the folks who are selling and distributing these items have necessarily been all that easy to work with at the local level. And I was especially disappointed yesterday to see in my own mailbox in Golden Valley, Minnesota, a flyer for 35 pages of aerial fireworks and directions to the border of Wisconsin. Really. It has my address on it. And so these are being marketed to folks, and I think for the consumers and in some cases even law enforcement, it's difficult to tell what is legal. And that's been a source of frustration, and it would be helpful to us if the industry would work a little more closely with the folks that have to do the enforcement.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can certainly testify to the work that law enforcement goes through 2 days previous and up to 2 days afterwards when dealing with fireworks. There's no question about it, and most of those that we do deal with are the ones that they go to Wisconsin to get, as well as South Dakota and my neck of the woods. But what we're talking about here is a whole different thing, and I think what Senator Higgins has there shows very clearly how much safer they are, and the igniting is where the injury actually comes in, is going up there and igniting it and going back. And if you're going to get the same display for less times igniting, you're going to have less injuries just with that particular product only is all.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Anything else, Representative Hackler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for letting me speak on this issue. And Senator Higgins, I did talk to the lobbyist for the Minnesota Fire Department and the Fire Chiefs Association. I know that Minneapolis Fire Department is opposed. They always have been. But those other fire department groups are not opposed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackforth, you'd probably get a chuckle out of it, because when all the fireworks start going, and it isn't 2 days before and 2 days after, it's like 2 months or a month before and a month after anymore. But when somebody calls the police to yell at them about the fireworks, they say, call your state senator. And, yes, never call your state rep. It's always call your state senator.
We can defer them to reps. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Well, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on any part of this bill? Any other comments from committee members? I think that this is the way we'd like to proceed, is that I know it's getting late, but maybe the House members, if we could meet for a brief time here, and if you'd like to do that, go back to the Capitol or meet here or however you'd like to do it. And we're going to reconvene. We'll vote on this on Monday, but we need to have some discussion. Obviously, there's still some outstanding issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Higgins, I don't know what you're doing. Yeah.
We can go back to the castle where it's warm.
It's freezing here, isn't it? Okay, so. I guess that's it. So thank you all members and staff. This meeting is adjourned.